Truth be told, I really have no idea what it is that I'm doing most of the time. And as such, I had this piece that I submitted just this past week about my Herman Lam bank robbery project. And keeping in tune with this notion that this particular podcast recording is kind of a director's commentary on some of the stuff that I'm working on, I wanted to talk about something that I had mentioned last week in a little bit more detail, which was about bankers associations, which I know sounds incredibly boring and incredibly dull, but it's one of the things that I actually ended up having to cut out of this piece because the piece needed to be about 4,000 words. And originally it was about 5,500, almost 6,000 words at one point. And so I kept kind of having to cut some things down. And one of the things that I had to cut was this discussion on the role of vigilantes and private bankers associations in the United States in the early 1900s. And so imagine for a second that it's about, you know, 1910, 1915 or so. And, you know, somebody gets the wild idea that there's a bunch of money in the bank. And wouldn't it be great if all that money just magically disappeared? And in a lot of these far-flung towns and being a little hamstrung in being able to hire people, maybe they're a little cash-strapped and can't afford the salary of hiring a deputy or a police department. Most places had a county sheriff, and maybe they had a constable or two at the most. And outside of the big cities, that was kind of about it. And so banks were pretty soft targets. And another interesting nugget is that state banks were much more common than national banks in that time. In Indiana, between 1916 and about 1936, state banks outnumbered national banks 3-1 on the average, and sometimes more than 4-1 at certain times. So banks, particularly rural state banks, were easy targets, situated often in the hinterlands where nobody was going to hear them scream. And, the notion that somebody could knock off these banks and walk away wasn't a far-flung idea. You can imagine that for a lot of desperate criminals, or even just people who were just kind of bored and wanted to show off a little bit, kind of like my Baron Lamb fella, it's not that bit of a stretch to realize that, yeah, they probably could just walk off with quite a bit if they chose to. And so they did. And so bankers associations, being private entities, kind of got tired of having to pay out, right? And so, like, if you're the Illinois State Bankers Association or the Iowa State Bankers Association, and most all of the banks in your state belong to, you know, your state and of your name, you're kind of responsible for that, right? These were precursors to larger corporations that we have today that sort of insure against loss of any kind, whether it be of theft or fire or flood or whatever. These guys were a little tired of paying out. And the bankers associations got together at one point, particularly in regions like in the Midwest between Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana and others, and started exchanging ideas about what to do in these circumstances. And it was pretty clear that government was not going to, at the time anyway, step up and produce some sort of more robust police force. By and large, it just didn't make economic sense to do that. It was kind of like holding up a plane in the 1970s, right? It just didn't make a whole lot of sense to do anything other than just let them take the plane. It was just cheaper to do that. And we continue to do this sort of stuff with things today as it is. Famously, credit card companies in the United States will continue to pay out and pay for loss prevention and scam prevention offices, and will just sort of write off the cost of fraud because it's cheaper than, you know, sort of replacing every terminal in the country or doing anything more robust than that. At the time, in the 1900s, banks were in the same spot. It just didn't make a whole lot of sense for a lot of cities and towns to beef up their police force just to sort of secure the banks. And so banks took it on themselves, which was sort of the notion of the day. The federal government was still particularly, as we think of it today anyway, a particularly weak institution. There was no FBI. Most states did not have state police. There were no highways that were of much significance at the time. Some of them were just sort of coming into their own. In Indiana, we had two at the time, two national highways anyway, US 40 and US 36. And so The bankers' associations decided that they would start training people, and it became, you know, sort of under their purview and in partnership with county sheriffs that they would arm people. They would train people how to shoot. They would host contests. Like I mentioned last week, they'd host these county shooting contests just to, you know, test their skills. And they were also unpaid. And so these vigilantes were unpaid volunteers. They were furnished pistols and shotguns and high-powered rifles from the bankers' associations, and they were appointed special deputy sheriffs, and they were to be prepared in the event of a bank robbery or any other emergency that called for plain dealing. And so, you know, you think about old episodes of like the Andy Griffith Show, for example, right? And you remember these episodes where, you know, a flood would come into town, or, you know, there'd be some big special guest, like the governor would come and visit or something, and, you know, they deputize Gomer or they deputize Goober. Or Otis, right? And so that was not uncommon. Like it was exactly how a lot of local police departments operated. It's actually still how some still operate in large parts of the United States, particularly in rural areas, where, you know, we are familiar with a volunteer fire department, but a volunteer police department is not that much different. And so the bankers' associations would sort of treat them as bank guards, right? And these guards served under the sheriff in the county. And sometimes the sheriff would appoint a county chief or some sort of supervisor over these vigilantes. Oftentimes that supervisor himself was also, you know, just among the volunteers, right? It was just a volunteer amongst the volunteers who volunteered to supervise the rest of the volunteers. And here's the nutty thing about it is that vigilantes were insured by the bankers association. So at the time, even in like, you know, the 1910s, the 1915, 1920, even on into the 1930s, before the FBI started to come into its own and before the state police in most states came about, somebody realized that maybe giving a bunch of good old boys with some guns and telling them to go shooting for some guys wasn't the best idea. And they insured against it. And so the bankers' associations covered the sheriff's departments against lawsuits that might have come about because of the actions of the volunteers and the vigilantes that the bankers' associations had deputized. And, you know, in my research for this, I came across the story of a fella in South Bend, Indiana. His name was Roland Goshen. And he said that, you know, he worked at a bank in South Bend when John Dillinger and Babyface Nelson and Homer Van Meter and others robbed a Merchants National Bank on June 30th, 1934. And this was a few years after Baron Lamb, in my story, and I won't spoil how that ends, but, you know, in that June 30th, 1934 robbery in South Bend, Dillinger came in, shot up the town, killed a policeman. And, Roland, he says, was, I was the secretary and treasurer of the St. Joseph County Vigilante Association. I bought 75 Smith & Wesson 38s and 45 frames. We had about 60 farmers deputized. And the idea was that if we had a robbery in South Bend, we'd call up all the farmers leading or on roads leading out of South Bend to call them and tell them what to do. And these guys were, you know, he goes on to explain that they were trained to shoot. And if they saw the car coming, they would, you know, they were trained to fall into a ditch and shoot the car after it passes, usually aiming for the gas or the tires to sort of slow the car down. And I'm always trained too to shoot it after it passes. So there was some training there to sort of keep them out of harm's way. But the nutty thing is that I think everyone realized that probably wasn't actually going to work out that way, that in most circumstances, these guys were, you know, going to go all Rambo on it and, you know, get themselves all greased up and stuff and put on the war paint and think that they were going to be the hero. And, you know, but most of the time these folks would, you know, they'd sign up and then a whole lot of nothing would happen, right? It was kind of like what we imagine being a firefighter is today, right? There's not a lot of fires by and large that happen on any given day. And so to keep performance up amongst these vigilante organizations, marksmanship competitions were organized usually on an annual basis at the county level. And typical of these competitions, you know, you'd have about, you know, 60 to 70, maybe even more of these vigilante volunteers, usually just usually farmers with a rifle, or, you know, gas station attendants or mechanics, or, you know, whatever. And, you know, they'd show up and they would test their skills and compete. And the competition with both pistols and rifles was designed to be presided over by the sheriff as sort of a skills competition. And a lot of these things had continued on long after the vigilante groups sort of dissolved or police departments were made more robust. And so these things, you know, we can still sort of see these vestiges in county fairs today in a lot of places. And, you know, the funny thing about all of these experiences is that in my research, I realized that town guards in a lot of cases were equipped with some pretty aggressive weaponry in a lot of cases. Like, we think about these as pistols and rifles, but they were actually super high powered pistols. In a lot of cases, the rifles were just sort of sawed off shotguns. And a lot of times they were told to shoot to kill when they had the need to. And they were reminded very frequently about the rewards for bandits that they might be able to take dead or alive in a lot of cases. It was kind of like a Wild West mentality to do this sort of stuff. And, you know, each county, you know, made note of its best scorer, and that score, just like what we think of today with county fairs, they would go on usually to be awarded with a prize, and prizes were handed out in individual events. And they would often go on to sort of regional or state level competitions. And these competitions had been going on in places like Illinois since like as early as 1925 in some cases. In Illinois, that's when town guards were initially first organized. And a bunch of the same thing was going on in Indiana. And by June of 1925, about 91 of the state's 92 counties formed vigilante organizations. And among the ones that hadn't formed vigilante organizations, one notable one was the Vermilion County, which is where the setting of my Herman Lamb piece takes place. And so here's this bank robber who shows up into town. He runs in, and there's no vigilante association in this particular county. I don't think Herman Lamb particularly knew or cared about that. I don't think that he chose this bank one way or the other as a result of that. We talk a lot about in this piece that I've been working on that Herman Lamb is the fella who sort of invented the idea of casing a bank, right? Like, this was another thing that I ended up having to cut, but they would practice like they were in a theater, and they would make sort of mock sets crude set pieces of what the bank layout was. By going into the bank, memorizing it, maybe jotting down a note or two, coming out, and then going into some, you know, farmland someplace or some back lot or whatever, and building out a little, you know, model of the bank. And they would make test plans for how to escape. They would map out precisely which turns to make, how long each turn should take, how fast to go down each stretch of road, how much time it should take to go down those roads. And as they were doing this, they would also accommodate any police patrols, and they would even prepare for adverse weather conditions. So if it was raining and they needed to slow down, they would know exactly what to do, where to turn, how to go, and usually all in pursuit of both a state line, because that's when most police officers, you know, would sort of give up and turn back. And they would also pursue paved roads. And there weren't that many of them in most states at the time. But on a dirt road, you'd be lucky to be doing about, you know, 35, 40 miles an hour. This was at a time in a lot of counties that most people still traveled around at, you know, maybe a top speed of about 15 to 20 miles an hour. This is, you know, a lot of cars, as they call them, automobiles or vehicles. Sometimes they would call them machines. They would very rarely call them cars. a lot of trucks just couldn't go much faster than that, particularly if they were hauling a big load or something, if they were hauling cattle or hogs or something like that. And on a paved road, you could easily get up to about, you know, 60 to 70 miles per hour without much fuss in a high powered car if you had, you know, the right vehicle. And so each county, you know, had this setup, and here comes Herman Lamb and totally takes advantage of all of it. But the nutty thing too is that I think that he underestimated what was going to happen in the Clinton bank. Because in Clinton, when he robbed the bank, he didn't do the usual stuff that he always did, right? He didn't case the bank. He didn't build the models of the bank. They had a little map that they would tape to the dash of, you know, the, where to turn and how to get to the, you know, at this point, US 40 as the paved road. But by and large, they didn't do anything else. They just kind of went in lackadaisical about it. And if not for some really bad luck, or as one of the reporters, Jack Sejnar, referred to it as a jinx, that followed them around, they probably would have gotten away with it. But thanks to some really serious vigilante groups and a couple of two extremely dedicated police officers, a couple of sheriffs, and a telephone operator who followed the action after this bank was robbed, a lot of you know, the stuff that people were afraid of in relation to vigilante groups, about like what are the, all the bad things that could happen, did happen. And all the bad things that could happen to the robbers happened. And all the bad things that could happen to the people in the bank, by and large, kind of happened. And this, you know, in a lot of cases, the rewards for these sorts of things wasn't the cash. A lot of times you could get $500 for some of these guys, you know, if you had a dead bank robber. If you shot somebody in the act of robbing a bank, maybe you get a little bit more. You know, at this time, you know, most people weren't worth a whole lot more than about $500, give or take. But in most counties in Indiana, between 25 and 50 people were trained in the use of firearms and were provided weapons from their county bankers associations. And ultimately, even the U.S. War Department, a lot of surplus stuff came in, particularly after the Civil War, and then later on after the Spanish-American War and a few other, you know, spats along the way, particularly against Native Americans. And it's just fascinating to me that in this whole experience that most people just never thought of it as being any other way. That it was the way that it was because it had to be that way. Because how would it be possible that a city or a county would maintain a police department or a sheriff's department robust enough to handle the situation? How could it be that the federal government of all things would have a police force that we now know as the FBI? It just didn't seem reasonable to people, and it just didn't seem necessary. And I don't think it was anything that anybody even really wanted. You know, 2/3 of all the bank robberies that took place in most states took place in just a handful of places. And so in the year 1925, for example, when the vigilante movement was really kicking in Illinois, of all the bank robberies, you know, 2/3 of them took place in about 8 states. It was California, Kansas, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas. And you're like, okay, well, Texas, California, maybe makes some sense. Michigan, maybe because it's on the border. But then you start looking around at places like Illinois, Indiana, and Missouri, and you start wondering what the heck's up with that. And that has everything to do with the complete surgence and authority of Chicago being as large a city as it was. And in these states, most all of the bank robberies that took place were in a handful of places in those places as well. So it's a lot like today in that regard. You know, if you're in Indiana, most of the bank robberies in Indiana are going to be taking place in Indianapolis and Fort Wayne and Lake County and the Chicagoland area and that sort of thing. So not a huge surprise there. And, you know, the other thing too is that daylight bank robberies were dropping as a result of these vigilante associations, because you're like, well, did this even actually work? And it did, because there was a, let me find the note here, in North Carolina in May 1926, the manager of one of the protective divisions there, James Baum, pointed out that in the 6 months prior to their sort of vigilante associations being in full force there, daylight bank robberies in those states were much higher. And in fact, daylight bank robberies in these states went down from 85 to 53, and burglaries dropped from 49 to 14 as these vigilante groups took hold. And I think we actually still see some of the vestiges of these numbers today. As a result, the United States still enjoys one of the lowest rates of home burglaries in any country in the world. And it's partly because, as most people theorize, that most burglars recognize that it's a pretty high but random chance that the home that you're burglarizing might have a gun in it, right? And so if you're not positive that that home is empty, or that that home is otherwise pretty defenseless, most people aren't keen to try to take their chances with that at random. And so it became with banks. And so these vigilante associations worked. And the, you know, bank losses went from as much as $200,000 a year to as low as about $2,500 a year later. Out of 1,000 Iowa towns, 781 enlisted vigilantes. And statewide, there were 3,876 vigilantes and $110,000 worth of reward money to be paid out for bandits. And that totaled, you know, a fraction of what the cost of the actual losses were. You know, it $110,000 worth of reward money, even in a place like Iowa in about 1915 or 1920, could easily have millions of dollars in losses. I mean, a single small town bank could have as much as $80,000 or $100,000 in it just for payroll if their, you know, town had a mining operation or an oil operation or some other large manufacturing concern that would have lots of workers that would need paid out all at once. That's not at all uncommon. So I have submitted this piece to an editor. I am excited about hopefully getting it back soon. I don't know when it will be, but as now that I'm kind of quote unquote done with this, until I can sort of get some revisions or input about it, because I'm hoping to get it published in a couple of state historical society publications here in Indiana. I'm going to be turning my attention back over to a couple of other projects that I'm working on, one of which is a family history and some genealogy research for a friend, and another is my Tri-State Tornado book. And so I'm really looking forward to start talking about that a little bit more as we progress.